From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westerveld, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Americans are growing more skeptical of experts and established knowledge, says author Tom Nichols. Just look at the denial of climate change, the anti-vaccine movement, and the spread of fake news. And Nichols says this rising anti-intellectual sentiment starts at the top.
You know, the president campaigned against experts. He said point blank on foreign policy, he said, what if I didn't have experts? Would it be so bad? And I was really concerned that he was going to try and prove that point in real time.
Coming up on Forum, Nichols joins us in studio to talk about his new book, The Death of Expertise, and we'll take your phone calls. Join the discussion. That's coming up on Forum after the latest news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westerveld with NPR, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Do Americans today value opinions over facts? Have Google and Wikipedia fostered a kind of superficial, instant expertise that gives us the illusion of knowledge? Climate change deniers, anti-vaccination campaigns, the spread of fake news. Is this nation founded on Enlightenment ideals of reason and an informed citizenry facing an epidemic of misinformation and anti-rationalism? Writer Tom Nichols argues that the growth of unreason threatens to undermine not just rational dialogue and key institutions in America, but he argues democracy itself. His new book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, and he joins us in studio now. Tom Nichols, welcome to Forum.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for having me.
In the book you write, I'm quoting here, I fear we're witnessing a Google-fueled, Wikipedia-based, blog-sodden collapse of any division between professionals and laymen, students and teachers, knowers and wonderers. In other words, between those of any achievement in an area and those with none at all, end quote. It's pretty strong language. Collapse?
I think so. I think that it's not just the collapse of communication between those two groups, there's now actually a positive hostility, at least from the non-experts to the experts. It's even perhaps that, as strong as that statement was, perhaps I understated it a bit.
So kind of this is the pointy-headed experts, and it's turned a little bit to anger, not just skepticism.
Right. And, there's a long tradition in American intellectual life of being skeptical of pointy heads and eggheads and intellectuals, and that's normal. And in fact, I'd even argue there's some that's actually a pretty good part of American culture, that we don't have that kind of old European deference to class and to, you know, we don't walk around calling people Herr Doctor, Professor, and use those kind of ranks. That's been a great part of our egalitarian culture. On the other hand, it's gotten completely out of control, where people now think that they are smarter than their doctors, that they know more about how to run the world than diplomats, that they understand the economy better than economists. I mean, it really has become a kind of hostile, angry, not just challenging of experts, but replacing of experts by lay people who really don't have any idea what they're talking about.
I mean, it's easy to blame the web, but you also mentioned that the language on social media, we're sort of hiding behind our computers a lot of times and lashing out at each other. And I wonder if you could talk about that, the role in which social media has played in the democratization of spreading information and news, but also in the tone.
Social media and the internet have actually been the enablers of a long-term process. This actually predates the internet. It goes back, I would say, a good 40 years. And there are a lot of reasons for it, including, I think, a growing culture. The word I use in the book that I think rubs a lot of people the wrong way, but I think it's the right word. It's a growing culture of narcissism. Mm. The problem with social media is it puts narcissism on steroids, because you sit behind your computer. You don't have to be face to face with any other human beings. You can say whatever you want. You're never held responsible for it. And people go to social media now primarily to win arguments or to affirm their own beliefs, rather than to communicate with other human beings in any kind of meaningful way. And so it takes all of these problems and it amps them up at the speed of fiber optics.
So the classic echo chamber has gotten a lot worse with social media.
Without a doubt. That social media, particularly the way that people can kind of compartmentalize social media so that they never actually have to run into anybody who disagrees with them, and in fact only run into people who strengthen their views, has become, I think, poisonous at this point.
How and in what ways, Tom, do you see the rise of Donald Trump and his election as part of this
ongoing pushback against established knowledge.
Well, the president ran against experts. I mean, it's not even by implication. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was quite explicit about, you know, the experts are terrible. What if I didn't have experts? The experts have, I mean, in a sense, the president's campaign was scapegoating of experts. And I think it's part of a global phenomenon, because the same thing happened during the Brexit debate, where the people who were part of the Leave campaign stood forward and said, you know, experts have ruined your lives. Experts are terrible. And I think that that's actually part of a global phenomenon. The president didn't create this wave. And I should note, by the way, I don't represent the Naval War College or the government here. It's my view in my book. But the president caught this wave and he surfed it probably more effectively than any other politician in the world right now.
Interesting. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're speaking with Professor Tom Nichols. His new book is The Death of Expertise. You can join the conversation at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. And Tom, you've written that much of the anxiety about President Trump is rooted in what you call the public's tragic ignorance of civics and government. But, you know, to push back on that, I mean, a lot of people are actually worried about his policies. You know, he's pushing on climate change, education, foreign policy, women's issue, Russia. There are specific things they're deeply worried about.
Well, important to point out that I actually started writing the book a couple of years before Donald Trump even hit the political scene as a campaign. So
although it feels pretty timely.
Yeah, I guess I was a little more prescient than I wanted to be. But I think what the president's campaign, at least when he was running, really the button he managed to push was this notion that that things are out of control, things are terrible, your life is a mess, and it's because of some expert somewhere. Now, the problem is when it comes to arguing about that, the various sides involved in these debates have almost no civic knowledge involved. And on this, I'm going to, you know, be an equal opportunity critic and say that Trump's critics and his defenders, especially I would say his defenders, really have very little foundational knowledge about how things like a budget gets done, or even how Congress works, why departments exist, how American federalism works. It's really disheartening because it's a dialogue of people who have no foundational knowledge about how their own system of government functions at all.
And yet he's turned some of that lack of expertise into a kind of badge of honor.
Oh, definitely. Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, people, one of the things that has struck me about this, and one of the reasons I was moved to write a book, you know, I think it's unfair. I should say I come from a working class neighborhood out in western Massachusetts. You know, I did not grow up around a lot of educated folks. I don't hold people responsible for not, you know, knowing Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. I get that. Mm-hmm. What I'm not used to, excuse me, is people being proud of it. Is people turning this into a positive virtue to say that because I don't know things, because I don't read a newspaper, because I am untouched by, you know, science or policy debates or anything, that I'm actually a more virtuous person by not knowing stuff. And I find that, you know, terrifying.
We're talking with author Tom Nichols about his new book, The Death of Expertise. And Tom, to push back a bit on your thesis, I mean, at times in American history, the cult of expertise has gotten us into some pretty ugly things. The Vietnam War, thalidomide babies, you could even say smoking and cancer rates. You know, as for decades, medical experts paid by tobacco companies tried to convince Americans smoking was harmless or even good for you. The Iraq War and its phantom weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I could go on. The list of expert advice gone very wrong is very long.
Absolutely. There's a whole chapter in the book called When Experts Are Wrong, and it talks about everything from policy failure to, you know, let's talk about the even more human part of it, which is fraud, abuse, misrepresentation, all of those things. Mm-hmm. With that said, I always make a few points about this. One is when it comes to political events like Vietnam, actually one of the most interesting things is that experts weren't really listened to. People forget that the book, The Best and the Brightest, referred to the fact that people who were kind of generally smart, and here, you know, there are echoes into our present time, people who are generally smart, like Robert McNamara, were brought in to override the regional experts and the military experts and the others, because really, Robert McNamara ran a big company, right? He ran General Motors. How hard could it be to run the Defense Department? And I think that's one of the dangers here, is that people think that experts, you don't need experts if you have, to quote a well-known politician, a very good brain. If you just think you're smart enough that you can solve all these problems. It's interesting, too. You mentioned thalidomide, which is one when I was writing the book. I called it the holy trinity of expert failure. People would say to me, but thalidomide, Vietnam, and Challenger. Right. Or sometimes they'd replace that with the Gulf War. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. First of all, thalidomide was 60 years ago. And every year, Americans take 300,000 over-the-counter drugs, not just prescriptions, but over-the-counter drugs that are perfectly safe. And they don't even think twice about it. But if you ask them about experts, they remember thalidomide because that's the astonishing moment of expert failure. The only other thing I'd say is that and the Trump campaign, I think, did this, you know, much to the grief of experts, is that people tend to write off democratic failures or failures of democracy as failures of expert advice. It is now revisionist history to talk about how unpopular the Gulf War was. In fact, the Gulf War was not that unpopular, at least in the United States and Britain, if you measured public opinion, and that the people who criticize academic experts, I actually was not one of them. I had a different view on the Iraq War, but a group of international relations experts were so desperate, they took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying, don't do this. This is a terrible idea. And of course—
And there were some protests, but they were largely ineffectual.
And they were largely ineffectual.
There was a lot of popularity.
Years later, when people say, you experts convinced us to do this, my answer is always, you know, we really didn't have to twist your arm that hard.
We're speaking with Tom Nichols. His new book is The Death of Expertise. You can join the conversation at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm going to take some calls. Amit is in San Francisco. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in this topic. I'm what they call a hospitalist, a pediatric hospitalist. I'm a hospital-based pediatrician, and we kind of deal with this a lot when patients come in and have looked things up, or there's some inherent distrust in the medical field about what's going on. And my question to you is, with all of this, the things you mentioned at the beginning about our society and what's engendering this kind of this distrust of experts, how do we shift the needle back? What can we do to build trust in experts and say, actually, these people are providing smart recommendations for you to make a decision rather than just going out and doing a search or just saying whatever you feel and thinking that that's the truth?
Good question. Turning to solutions, Tom.
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, I tend to be somewhat pessimistic about this because I think one of the things that drives the death of expertise is affluence, which is going to sound strange, right? People say these are tough times. There's so much uncertainty and so many things are out of control. I actually don't think that's true. And in fact, when people argue with doctors, it's usually because they're feeling pretty healthy. Mm. I have said for years that the one thing that would bring the anti-vaccine movement to an end is a pandemic. Mm. One of the reasons I had no problems and my family had no problems signing me up for the polio vaccine was that we knew people in my family who had polio. It was visibly in front of us. We could see the effects of polio and of people who had not been vaccinated. I mean, we knew people who had as archaic, and I'm really not that old. I'm only 56, but mm-hmm. as archaic as it is to say, we knew people had smallpox. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, some kind of brush with some kind of an epidemic could do it. With that said, I'm trying to be more optimistic, but I think that the public has a tendency to view this kind of medical advice, for example, kind of your caller talked about, as a heads I win, tails you lose conspiracy approach. If you agree with them, well, then if you give any inch on it, they say, well, so you say I have a point. Well, sometimes, yeah, it's good to ask. It's always good to ask your doctor questions. Mm. On the other hand, if you argue with the patient, and many doctors, I talked to a lot of doctors for this book, tell me that the minute that they diverge from what the patient wants, they're part of a big medical conspiracy. They're in on it. I mean, it almost puts them on the side of the enemy. A surgeon, actually, interestingly enough, pediatric surgeon, much the same world your caller works in, said at one point that the patient's mother finally said, well, I don't care what you think. You have to do what we want. Which he, you know, he was stunned and he stood back and he said, I actually don't have to cut into a child simply because you're demanding that I do it. But that's
patients are just saying, I'm a Google search away from proving you wrong.
Doctors have an expression for it. They call it paging Dr. Google.
Interesting. We're going to take some more calls. Andrew in Oakland, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I think people are resentful about the institutions that grant all this expertise being basically owned and attended by only people who have already entered this investor class, which is, the institutions themselves are not also instilling an ethic in the people that are attending them to not undermine the lives of everyone else. I mean, Harvard Business School gave us all the innovations in Wall Street that effectively removed vast amounts of wealth from working people and given it to the investor class whose children are going to attend Harvard.
Who's making a case the inequality impact on the death of expertise?
Yeah, I'd say a couple of things about that. There is a whole chapter in the book on higher education and why I think it's failing in its mission to create more critical thinking and better democratic citizens. But I do take issue with Andrew, who, Thane, thanks for the call, because there's always this conflation of experts and elites. Mm-hmm. And they are not always the same thing. I am an expert. I don't know that I would call myself an elite. I live in a modest home in Rhode Island. I teach at a government institution in the day and for an open enrollment extension program at night. There are a lot of people with a lot of education who are experts who are not, masters of the universe. And the notion that Harvard Business School annihilated Wall Street, this really rankles colleagues who are economists because they say, look, economists who are the experts on how to do this and are the disinterested experts on how to do this, we're telling you all along, don't do the things you're doing. Don't give mortgages to uncreditworthy people. Don't create crazy financial instruments that will just make you rich. And nobody wanted to listen to that. And then when it all came down, they said, well, you experts told us this was a good idea. Well, no, we experts didn't tell you that was a good idea. And I think, I think there is an issue here of course, of power and privilege that we create an expert class that can get, and I've said this many times in talking about the book, that we create an expert class that has a lot of division from the people whose decisions have to live with their decisions. On the other hand, I also think this notion that every time something goes wrong, the public turns. I think experts have withdrawn because every time something goes wrong, the public turns to us and says, well, you told me to do this. Well, even when we didn't tell you to do that, we get that charge that somehow we created this situation. And it's usually not true.
That gets to a good question that's coming in online. A listener writes, how can a layperson really determine who's an expert and who's a charlatan? Who might have a way with words. Most laypersons aren't equipped to verify whether an expert's research is really free from a special interest group's agenda or not. It's a valid point.
That's an absolutely valid point. I have some recommendations for it. Right at the top of the book, I talk about who's an expert. And this links back to your previous caller as well. Credentials – people in America now have become kind of we always were, but I think it's gotten worse. We're a little cranky about credentialing in part because it costs so much money, whether it's a college degree or a professional license or whatever it is. My argument is credentialing is only part of the game, that credentialing does not make an expert. It's sort of like the ticket to entry. There are other things. And I think when it comes to who's putting out shabby research, the most important check on experts are other experts. Now, people don't want to hear that because they think it's back scratching and butt covering and all of that stuff. But the fact of the matter is internal review, whether it's doctors watching over doctors, lawyers watching over lawyers, academics, peer reviewing and checking.
Journalists watching over journalists, that's shoddy work.
Mm-hmm. Journalists are the best watchdogs of other journalists, to be honest, because they know all the tricks. Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing that's required here, and I'm not sure how to rebuild this, and one of your callers has already asked about it, is rebuilding that sense of trust that these fields are policing themselves in some effective way. But the one thing I would tell your callers is when you see someone on television who says, I'm an expert, the one place where Google is useful is Go look them up. Find out where they went to school. Find out what they've written. Find out who publishes their books. Mm. See what think tanks they've worked for. It's not that hard. For years, I don't have a blog anymore. I just decided it was, you know, blogs were becoming part of the problem, so I took mine down. But for 5 or 6 years, I kept my entire curriculum vitae, my entire academic resume, posted on the internet in its entirety for anybody that wanted to go read it. And I think that an expert who's willing to do that, I think, is an expert who is more trustworthy than one who's dodgy about, you know, whether they plagiarized their thesis or made, you know, who they've worked for and where they get their money.
That's a good point. Let's take some more phone calls. George in Palo Alto, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to make sure that we acknowledge that expertise in theory is just theoretical, and only in theory and practice are the same. And a real expert is an expert who has a lot of practical experience based on the theory. And for that, I would recommend, and I'm sure your author has read and understood, Nassim Taleb, the famous guy who wrote many, many books on expertise, and also coined the brilliant term IYI for intellectual yet idiot, which means the very learned, very smart people who have zero practical expertise. What do you think about that?
Well, I'll admit my own bias right up front and tell you that Taleb hates my book and hates the work I've done. He actually said on Twitter that he would never write for Foreign Affairs again because they published an excerpt from my book. So he feels pretty strongly about it. But I would say two things about this. One is I think you're right. Experience is a really important part of that. That experience. You know, I have not spent my life abstractly studying international affairs and Russia. I've been to Russia many times. I worked for a senator. I worked, did work for the defense and intelligence communities. It is important to get your hands dirty and to do the thing that you claim to be good at. There's no doubt about it. Now, if you're an expert on, you know, 14th century French poetry, you're not going to spend a lot of time, you know, doing anything else but being an expert on that. And I think people have to respect that there are some forms of knowledge that are just esoteric. When it comes to Taleb, I think one important thing, and my fellow Oxford author Dan Dresner has been writing about the difference between public intellectuals and thought leaders. Mm-hmm. And I do have one criticism of the kind of Taleb approach, which is that it almost seems like the view is anybody who claims to be an expert or who has an expert field is by definition an idiot, because Taleb has a very single-minded approach to what constitutes knowledge, and it's very narrow. In the big debate between foxes and hedgehogs, the hedgehogs have very narrow but deep in knowledge, and the foxes know many things. I tend to side more with the foxes. I think that broad knowledge is more important. And that's how you integrate the hedgehogs into a larger and better, I think, use of knowledge for the good of an overall human community.
The Death of Expertise with Tom Nichols. Lots more to talk about. We're going to take your calls, keep the conversation going. What questions do you have for Tom Nichols? You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786 and join the conversation at 866-733-6786. There's more to come. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support comes from the San Francisco Foundation, proud sponsor of Forum. The San Francisco Foundation works with its donors and community partners on a bold equity agenda for greater racial and economic inclusion for everyone in the Bay Area. History tells us that when community leaders, nonprofits, donors, residents, and business partners work together, all Bay Area residents benefit. Learn more at sff.org. Support also comes from the University of San Francisco Master of Science in Organization Development Program, preparing professionals to lead people, teams, growth, and change in business and beyond. With a Master's in Organization Development from USF, help individuals and organizations thrive. To learn more about our small class sizes, once-a-week evening format, and Bay Area connections, visit usfca.edu/msod.
Welcome back to Forum from KQED. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking about why Americans are growing more skeptical of experts and established knowledge with author and Professor Tom Nichols. He'll appear at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow at noon and at 7:30 tomorrow at Kepler's Bookstore in Menlo Park. If you've got a question for Tom, give us a call, 866-733-6786. Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And Tom Ben writes in, you know, currently the entrepreneurs are driving this economy with disruptive technologies. You know, we are in the heart of Silicon Valley. Disruptive technology, he writes, is inherently irreverent to experts and expertise. The thinking is that if people listened to the experts, there would be no Google, no Microsoft, no Facebook, no Uber, and more. Your response to that, that it takes a certain break things and move fast to attitude?
Well, I think it's a false dichotomy, because I think when I talk about respect for experts, people get this kind of outdated notion, like some kind of a scene from a bad 1950s movie, you know, where Mr. Potter is, you know, sitting there and telling you impertinent young men to respect the old ways. And that's really not what I mean. I actually think of all of these as innovations that add to each other. I mean, Google is a great example because it's built, let's face it, without an internet, there wouldn't be a Google. Why was there an internet? Because there was a community of experts who, ironically enough, were actually trying to win the Cold War. That all of the things that you're thinking of today as a disruptive technology in terms of the internet all comes from actually an attempt to create an information network that would survive a nuclear attack, which was all part of coming out of the wreckage of World War II and creating creating the Cold War. We should also issue an expert correction. Robert McNamara, speaking of the Cold War, was head of Ford.
Not GM.
Not GM. Sorry.
Good correction.
Yeah, he's an
Edsel.
Of course. You know. Yeah,
we stand corrected. But it's a good point. They married expertise technology, but with disruptors, with
yes.
visionaries, with people that wanted to take risks.
Disruptors are crucial to this. And in fact, disruptors, I think, become experts in their own right. I think when I talk about the death of expertise, think about the way this death of expertise is expressed in the way most people would experience it. Like one of your callers, where a doctor says, hey, you need to do this. And people say, well, you know what? I don't think I do. I read something, or I clicked on something. It would be like somebody who works in the knowledge industry here in Silicon Valley and works at Google, and somebody says, oh, you work for Google? Here, let me explain a few things to you about Google. Well, immediately that person might say, well, I do this every day. Why don't you, I can tell you things about it. And I think this notion that, well, I read a few stories, I clicked on a few things, I walked past the television while it was on, now I'm your peer. Now I'm going to explain to you what you do all day long is part of how this relationship between lay people and experts is collapsing.
Let's take some more calls. Lisa in Los Altos, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. It's my first time ever calling in, and I've listened for years and years. So
welcome.
I want the author to comment on this. I think there are two really separate phenomena going on with the denial of expertise. I think on the one hand, you have this type of denial that's typified by the sort of ignorance, proud, Trump-style denial of climate change science. And I want to talk about later, there's a really specific conflict going on behind that type of denial. And then on the other hand, you have a subject that's very near and dear to me, which is the denial of medical expertise. We are now becoming aware as consumers that medical, quote, expertise, unquote, is being informed by a very powerful industry, the pharmaceutical industry. And most of the, in quote, science being fed to doctors this research is actually being funded by the pharmaceutical industry. So what we're coming to learn, because of the incredible democratization of information provided by the internet, is we're coming to learn as really smart consumers. I graduated top of my class from UCLA. I have a law degree from Berkeley. I'm not a medical person, but I'm a huge consumer of medical information on the internet. And because there's a lot of really
okay. Point well taken. We thank you for your call. It's a great point. She raises a legitimate question about the commercial political interests of those doing the research. Your response, Tom?
She does, and I'll get to it in a moment. But first, I'll point out and thank you for calling, Lisa. But I have to say, you are exactly an example of what I'm talking about. You say, well, you know, I'm a smart person, and I have the internet, and I see a lot of the hidden hand of corporations behind things, and I don't trust anybody. But I'm the smart consumer. It's the Trump voters. You know, this is a problem that spans both political parties. It does not discriminate between genders. It does not discriminate among races. Everybody is starting to fall into this pit and expressing it in different ways. The people who are the best to decide whether or not pharmaceuticals are appropriate for their patients are not people with a laptop computer. It's other doctors. But we forget that doctors are scientists. Doctors are trained scientists. They will push back. Now, yes, have there been scandals? Have there been drugs that have been pushed by pharmaceutical companies that doctors have prescribed? Sure. Experts make mistakes and bad things will happen. But in the end, I always come back to the simple problem that the best remedy to a bad expert is a better expert. It is not a lame person. If you think that your dentist is bad, the answer is to find a better dentist. It's not to try to pull your own tooth.
But she was talking specifically about the medical industry and conflict of interest around funding too, which is
absolutely. But the problem is first of all, drugs have to get researched and funded. And they're not always going to be – that's not always going to happen publicly. But even within that, there are methods of science that other scientists can check. For drugs that make it, so many more fail. If the pharmaceutical industry were just pumping drugs out into the market, very few drugs would fail because that's a loss of money. The fact is a lot of drugs fail in testing. Most drugs fail in testing, as they probably should. And that's no pharmaceutical company can control that. On the other side, the issue of climate denial, I wanted to make one point about this, which is that a lot of people out there are pushing back on common sense and scientific fact, not because deep down they don't believe it, but because they think that it's some kind of expression of their autonomy. And this is something that's really worrisome. That to me, people who push back against experts, whether it's about drugs or whether it's about climate change or whether it's about the economy or whether it's about what to do about ISIS, it's all a way of saying it's almost a childlike way of saying you're not the boss of me.
It's become an expression of self and self-identity.
It's actualization. Yeah. It's a way of saying, I am an independent, autonomous person. I make my own decisions. When, in fact, going all the way back to Richard Hofstadter's classic on this, Hofstadter wrote in the early
60s. Anti-intellectualism in American life.
Absolutely.
Which won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah. And Hofstadter said, if the average person were honest with himself, he would have to say that he doesn't understand most of the things that he deals with, starting with his toaster in the morning. And I think people should find that less threatening than to think of it as part of the natural division of labor. But instead, we've developed this idea that they have to push back on every single thing you don't understand and with a slight tinge of paranoia behind all of it, that everything that you don't understand is being controlled and run by people who don't have your interests at heart.
But Hofstadter argued that these sort of anti-intellectual utilitarian themes were part of the democratization of knowledge unique to American culture. There was something unique about the American culture and society that was cultivating that. You're kind of making an argument that with the web and social media, that's expanded the democratization of knowledge, but put it on steroids and created a warped sense that we're all experts.
And not just in the United States. It's going global. And one of the things, the book's been out now for about 2 or 3 months, one of the things that has struck me is how resonant it's been in other countries. It's a bestseller in Canada, of all places.
Interesting.
There will be editions in Japanese and Chinese and Korean. So it's clearly hitting a nerve in places other than the United States.
Let's take some more calls. Scott, you are on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller as well. My question is around groupthink from expert to expert. If you do take the phenomenon of global warming, I think that's a good example of other theories that are scientifically based being shut down. And again, because this concept of experts have made the decision. So my question is really around how do we address that, where we could still look at scientific data around a particular issue that gets to a solution and breaks down the expert and their ownership of it, in particular in a group environment, versus the real data that can lead to the solutions that we're trying to get to?
Group, that's a great question, because groupthink is a real problem in any environment, whether it's a small business or the cockpit of an airplane or trying to, you know, cure cancer. Groupthink is a dangerous phenomenon, and it's a normal human phenomenon. One of the things I point out in the book is that a lot of the problems people have with expertise is just the way we're designed as human beings. We like to be right. We like to agree with other people who confirm what we already think. That's just how we're hardwired as social beings. There's a couple of ways around this. One is, I think peer review, as broken as it is in a lot of American fields, peer review is still the most important mechanism for trying to interject into that groupthink. I think when it comes to climate change, the word, though, that – or to similar fields, not just climate change but others, it's not just groupthink. It's tribalism. Where people have really dug in their trenches, and neither side wants to give an inch because they think the other side will run with it. The scientific community, if they say, look, you know, as scientists should, they say, look, you know, we don't know anything to 100% certitude, but we're pretty sure about X, Y, and Z. They're concerned that people will jump at them and say, oh, so you admit you don't know. Mm-hmm. And the people who are pushing against this because they're concerned about losing their way of life, they're concerned about the economic impact of regulation or, you know, coal or whatever it is, they don't want to say, you know, the world would be a better place without dirty skies and you know, fouled rivers, and they're concerned that the experts will say, so you agree that we have to eliminate your way of life. And so each side, fueled by these echo chambers, fueled by a media that lets them cherry pick their views, fueled by Facebook and Twitter and the other things that make us kind of meaner than we have to be, go into their trenches and never talk to each other.
Well, one listener writes in, what connection, if any, exists between, you know, the decline of fact-based views and fundamentalist religions, some of which deny science?
I think that that's too easy a shorthand. I mean, there's always been fundamentalism in American life, and most Americans, I think, have had at least we're a Protestant country, and there's a strong evangelical movement that's always been there. I don't think that that's as much a problem as it is that people have been able to take their religious views and compartmentalize those and then deny science and facts and not even read the news for reasons other than their religion. Because, you know, one of the things that strikes me in all – because I've been asked that question many times – is that to me the death of expertise and the denial of facts and reality has actually happened as Americans have become less religious and not more. And I'd also add, you know, if you really to kind of give equal time to what I think a lot of folks out there, at least in the academic community, would argue has had an equal I can't say equal, but a strong influence as well, is that while you have this problem of religious fundamentalism, you've also had a trend of 40 years of postmodernism in the American Academy, which has taught young people to think, well, you know, things are what I think they are. There are no actual facts. Things are relative. Everything is a matter of interpretation. So we've had a couple of really bad strains, both in the American right and the American left, the educated elite and the uneducated folks out in the, you know, the heartland, both rejecting knowledge but for different reasons.
That gets to a question a listener sends in. And I was thinking about this in reading the book over the weekend. You know, sort of death of expertise compared to what? Are you kind of hearkening back to a mythical golden age of expertise that maybe didn't exist? I mean, we talk about the cult of expertise got us into some messy situations.
Definitely.
Are you kind of romanticizing expertise?
Well, I don't think I'm romanticizing expertise, but I understand the criticism that I'm talking about a golden age. And as I say in the book, there was never a golden age. I mean, there was a time, for example, when the groupthink problem, the, you know, fusing of expertise to elites was much worse. I mean, that knowledge was basically the exclusive province of educated white males. And that was, in a way, we live in a much more diverse information sphere today than we did 50 years ago. My concern is that with all of this knowledge, we've never had more information. We've never had more access to news and to facts and to science. We live at the highest standard of living we've ever known as a human civilization. That's when people have decided to dig in and say basically that science is bunk.
Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum. Again, 866-733-6786. Let's take some more calls. Annette in San Jose, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, my name is Annette. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 58-year-old woman with a family history of heart disease who lost her twin brother at the age of 38. And so for the last 20 years, I've been under cardiovascular care, you know, doing all the right things, watching my weight, exercising, and went undiagnosed for 18 years until I had a 99.9% block in my LAD. And I really found that out because I was my own advocate and pushed through the medical system to get the right test. So I guess I'm just coming on the air to say how important it is to have knowledge and to be your own advocate because it can save lives.
Thanks for your point.
I don't disagree with any of that as long as you're an informed advocate, that you are an informed consumer. And this is actually what I've been pleading with people to do. Be involved in your healthcare. Be involved in your community. Be involved in your political system. But do it with a certain amount of foundational knowledge and information. I mean, obviously, this, Annette, and I'm glad that you're feeling healthy, and I'm glad that things are going well for you. But the reality is that she is working with a community of experts who know how to take care of her, that a lot of the things that she's looking into that are helping her to be an advocate for her own health came from an expert community of medical professionals, which isn't, you know, doctors. I tell a story in the book where doctors had a teenager and they kept telling who had some weird symptoms, and they kept telling her, stop Googling your symptoms. You don't have some weird, rare cancer. Well, she was the one in a billion case where she had some weird cancer and it killed her. But that doesn't mean that that Google is smarter than your doctor. It means you need to work with your doctor or with, you know, again, if it's things like public policy, with your local community officials, with civil engineers, with whoever it is. And when people say, how do I do this? I say, read a newspaper. Start by reading a newspaper every morning.
Anthony writes in, I always feel like experts are trying to sell me something. You're on a book tour. I'm just wondering, you know, are there inherent conflicts of interest there when you're talking about it?
Yes, I'm trying to sell you a book, actually. but yeah, experts, of course, are trying to sell you something. They're trying to sell you expertise. They're trying to sell you, the knowledge that they've gained that they think is actually going to make your life better. Expertise. In the book, I really strongly argue that experts, our clients, are not the immediate person in front of us. That's the client we're helping at that moment. But the client of every expert, whether it's a journalist like you or a professor like me or a doctor like Annette, our clients are all society. Professionals, because we have this knowledge, because we've had the ability to gain this kind of expertise, our requirement is to help the society we live in. Are there experts who misuse that? Are there charlatans and snake oil salesmen? Of course there are. But again, people have started to focus on the miscreants in the expert community. And I think part of the reason they do that is so they can get themselves off the hook for not listening to experts. You doctors were wrong about eggs, therefore I don't have to listen to you about losing a few pounds.
And I'm pretty glad doctors were wrong about eggs. Craig in San Mateo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Interesting conversation. Just a comment. I think some of the callers have maybe touched upon this subject, and my specific comment had to do with disagreement amongst experts. So you could imagine an area of expertise, and I work in biotechnology, by the way. So, I've seen this for quite some time, so it's not something that's relatively new. And I suspect that it's gone on since the arguments about calculus in the past. But I think it's just kind of interesting to see the parallels here. You have a field of experts, and in the scope of a larger project, they're cooperating on some device or protocol or some end result.
You're talking about experts trumped by higher level experts? Is that what you're
And there might be political motivations. Maybe there's power struggles, basic human psychology. But it seems like, and I've had this conversation with one of my colleagues, and he says that this is par for the course. He has a high level view of different sequencing technologies. So he has the ability to look under the hood and kind of evaluate not only technologies, but the dynamics. But I think what was interesting to me was that in a group of people where they're making database decisions, It seems like people that have deep knowledge of a subspecialty that enhances an overall project or is a component of the overall project frequently are ignored.
Well, this is the...
Thanks for your call, Craig.
This is the foxes versus hedgehog problem, that the people with super deep knowledge in a narrow area have a tendency to believe that they can generalize that knowledge outward. And there's actually a very good book on this that isn't mine, so I'll plug another book. There's an academic named Philip Tetlock who wrote about how experts predict things and who's better at prediction. Hedgehogs, the people that are very narrow in their specialization, tend to be very good at that one thing, but they have a lot of trouble seeing a bigger picture. Foxes,
the siloification.
Yes.
And not looking at the connections between the other fields.
Right. And sometimes they resent that because they say, you know, I'm the physicist who knows, you know, this one issue very deeply, where there may be somebody at a higher level saying, but we're building a nuclear bomb. We need to think about bigger issues about why we're building this. You know, one of the classic cases of this, of an expert in one thing who then, you know, tried to generalize out, was Edward Teller. The father of the hydrogen
bomb.
Father
of the atomic bomb.
And he spent a lot of time advising people in Washington about what to do with the hydrogen bomb after designing one. I don't know that that was really the best idea, but I think that this is a natural tension. And, you know, human beings are always involved, so we're always going to be annoying and get on each other's nerves about this. But I think there's a natural tension between the deep knowledge and the people who have to integrate that across fields and into some kind of larger social project.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Tom Nichols about his book, The Death of Expertise. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, the last day. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Eric Westervelt. And Tom, getting back to the issue of silification, I think if I could point to one thing in my career as a journalist I keep running up against, it is that people are experts in their field but often aren't communicating with other experts in a meaningful, collaborative way, whether it's poverty, education, medicine, the list goes on. It's like, I'm an expert in my lane.
Right.
But then say, so wait a minute, the connection over here. And they're often saying, well, why aren't you talking to this person about housing? Well, it's just not the way it works. And I feel like maybe this is some post-war, the way academia was set up. I'm not sure. The silofication, get to that.
Well, we used to have people who cut across those fields to try to help and to integrate those, and we called them public intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And the problem is the public intellectuals have come under a great attack. One of your callers mentioned Taleb. I mean, people like that are, you know, really feel that public intellectuals should stay in very narrow lanes and stay out of these larger issues. But the fact is, we live in a large, complex society, and I think experts should reach out to each other. And I think experts need to do a better job of communicating with the public, because we have withdrawn from talking to the public because it has gotten so difficult. Most experts, I think, you know, if people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Radio Free Tom. You'll see I have a pretty thick skin. Most experts don't. They do the thing they do. They don't really want to take a lot of abuse about it. And so instead, they just kind of pull back and say, you know, I'm just going to talk to not just to other experts, but only the experts in my field who understand me. And I think that's a dereliction of our duty as experts to our client society overall.
Well, it seems like it's state, local, federal governments as well. There could be more fruitful interactions between experts outside of government. And let's go to some more phone calls as well. Lila has been waiting patiently. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I just want to ask the author how he would respond to the over 300,000 people each year in the United States that contract Lyme disease and are told they don't have it. And then of that, about 60,000 a year who are told that they know they have chronic Lyme disease and told that it doesn't exist.
You want to take that
Lyme disease? I don't know. I mean, I'm not their doctor, and I don't know where those numbers come from. I will say that doctors misdiagnose things all the time. But again, in the large question of experts versus lay people, you know, the question is who should be diagnosing and treating you, you or, you know, somebody who sent you a meme on Facebook with a picture of a tick bite. I don't know how often Lyme disease is misdiagnosed, but let's just stipulate a lot of diseases are misdiagnosed. I was misdiagnosed when my appendix almost ruptured. The doctors told me, they said they still had a 50-50 bet. They were betting each other a six-pack on what they were going to find when they opened me up.
Doctors are human. This
doctors
just in.
Are human, and you know, I thought it was pretty honest of them to say that, you know, we were pretty much flipping a coin when we cut into you to find out what was going on, and yet 30 years later, here I am.
Online, Brian asked a good question: why is global warming denying seemingly such an American phenomenon?
Because in America, and that's a good question. Because in America, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, we're a federal nation as opposed to a unitary state, as many of the other countries around the world are. And so we, more than most countries, have a lot of tensions between national and local power, I would say more than most countries in the developed world. The other is because I think that that our respect for science has been overplayed, and on this I'm going to point a finger at the scientists, into saying that, you know, because we are so good at the science, therefore you must accept our conclusions about policy. Last time I was in California, I was talking to a group from the National Academy of Sciences, and I said, you know, you're as right as scientists can be, but policy is still policy. And people have the right to be wrong. The way I put it in the book is, you know, if the people of Boston want to make a decision to let the city slide into the harbor 50 years from now, it's a stupid decision, but it's a decision they have a right to make. And I think scientists overplayed their hand by saying that because the science says that we're right about this issue, therefore our policy recommendations are irresistible. And I think that does trigger something in the American character that says, you know, eggheads can't just tell me how to vote, you know, just because science is science. And I think that that's an unfortunate rift between the scientific community. I grew up in the time when people said, hey, they put a man on the moon. How wrong can they be? But now I think the average person says scientists don't know anything and I don't have to listen to them because they want to change my life.
Well, I found it an excellent and timely read. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters by Tom Nichols. I'm Eric Westervelt, in for Michael Krasny this week. You're listening to Forum. Thanks a lot for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti-Schramm, founders of the Minetti-Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.